Thank you. This will be a mixture of some things, part of which were inspired by the meeting. I thought I'd say just two view graphs on high mobility MBE. The title is Quantum Wire Exciton Lasers. then we'll tell you, and I think you seem to know that from other view graphs, you probably know this, but how this growth on a cleaved edge works. I'm going to mention the Amir Yacoby work about quantum wires briefly. Then I'm going to talk mostly about optics and quantum wires and quantum wire lasers and some excitonic effects we've seen. And there's a poster paper about some of these excitonic effects that you can look at if you want to know more. In terms of mobility, this is a plot of the mobility plotted on this axis versus temperature of two samples I grew quite a while ago. One is a high mobility sample, and one is a higher mobility sample. And all we did, you're going to ignore this business, it's not relevant. All we did, and Horst did this with me several years ago, was take a point for point subtraction of the data and plotted it. And it shows you that this, by the way, is for a sample with an R sub S of the order of 1, or maybe even part less than 1. It's about 2/10 of the 11 electrons. What it shows is that there's clearly sort of a proof that there's an independent impurity scattering, which is at the control of the experimenter if they're clever enough to figure out how to control it. And so that when you see a flat temperature dependence, you have to be... there's lots of reasons for that, and one of them is not very interesting, and that's this fact that the ionized impurity scattering is, in fact, temperature independent. Now, for holes, that should occur as well, I would suspect, and so or for very low-density electrons. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. And the second is just to sort of give you a status report on high mobility. We grew a sample in the fall of 97, which was 18 million. But oddly enough, the best-looking samples were grown earlier in a different way. We spent some care to do something where we controlled the dopant granularity. We do that by putting an aluminum arsenide barrier near the dopant, in the dopant plane, so that some of the electrons can be shared and hop along and take some of the granularity of the dopant plane away. And when we do that, we see samples which, even though the mobility is only 7 million, in fact have much nicer fractional counts all the way to 19/17. So by looking at mobility, that's not really a very good number necessarily for many of the things that people here want to know when you're looking at magnetotransport. So now let's go to the talk itself. And this is this cleaved edge overgrowth. This has been shown in the last talk, better than this, actually. What it is, it's a two-growth molecular beam epitaxy technique. So the first growth is entirely conventional, and you can grow it on any interface that you want to if you know the growth conditions. Typically, for gallium arsenide, it's the 1-0-0 growth direction. So you grow a barrier, a quantum well, and a barrier. No doping. And in step two, you cleave it. And in step three, you grow something on the cleaved overface. If you grow aluminum gallium arsenide and you dope it with silicon, that makes a quantum wire, provided that the quantum well that you grew here, the undoped quantum well, is narrow enough so that you see quantum effects. Our first experiments, in fact, this was very wide. We made this 5 or 10 microns, and we didn't want quantum effects. We didn't want a quantum wire. We wanted to just measure the two-dimensional electron gas. So the lateral confinement of this quantum wire is made by the first growth, these barriers, and the vertical confinement, this direction, is made by the attraction of the electrons back to the charged parents. Now, in this talk, we're going to be talking about two kinds of quantum wires. And you're supposed to look at these diagrams by imagining you're sighting down the axis of the wire. And this is the one we were just talking about, where the dopant, which is positive silicon, is attracting the electrons back, but there's a half plane that's terminated of gallium arsenide, and so the electrons are confined on three sides by the algas, and on the fourth side by this electrostatic attraction. The interesting thing about this wire is that there's very strong confinement. That's the good thing. The bad thing is that the confinement is four electrons or four holes in a separate sample, but it's not for both in the same sample, and it's not for excitons at all. There's no exciton confinement. And the bad thing is that in this sample, the holes would in fact be unconfined, would in fact be repelled. So because of this difficulty of only electrons, we thought about other methods. And one of the methods we've been working on is intersecting quantum wells. And in that situation, you just have two wells that are intersecting, and you can make weak confinement of electrons and holes and excitons all in the same sample at the same time. And we use these mostly for our optics experiments. If any of you anyone here has other ideas for confinement, they are very welcome. And please come and see me. So to do cleaved edge overgrowth, you have to remember that the natural cleavage plane of gallium arsenide is the 110 plane. So if you take some gallium arsenide and you break it, it will break very cleanly at room temperature, and it will show a perfect monotonic or monoatomic surface with no steps, and it will be 110, because those are the bonds that are in fact have the lowest density. And so it breaks and gives you this surface. So you have to then learn how to cleave. Well, cleaving in vacuum is easy. Cleaving at high temperature in vacuum is less easy, because essentially the damage you make when you do a scratch or something to start the cleave is healed by the high temperatures. But you can overcome that by controlling your temperature budget. You can then grow on this newly exposed surface, but it has to be kept pristine until the growth starts. And then finally you have to learn these growth conditions for 110. The 110 growth conditions actually were the whole problem. The reason I think it hadn't worked in the past was that this is the growth surface, this top plane. And what you have is a gallium and an arsenic in alternating paths. So there's no polarity to this surface. There's no particular reason why additional arsenic would want to stick to that surface. So you have to increase the arsenic pressure, and in fact you do all sorts of things to improve the arsenic incorporation in the growing material. You lower the substrate temperature by 150 degrees. That improves the arsenic's residence time on a surface. You increase its flux by factors of 2 or 3, and you reduce the competing gallium growth rate by about a factor of 2. All things which have put roughly an order of magnitude more arsenic on the surface than they would be in a normal MVE experiment. Now, the problem with this is when you lower this growth temperature by 150 or more degrees, that everything sticks better. Not just the arsenic sticks better, but all sorts of other things stick better. And I would say the reason that other people aren't doing cleaved edge overgrowth is because of the high mobility that we talked about in the first two V-graphs actually is irrelevant here. You have to have a machine where there isn't a lot of dirt that otherwise would stick on this low temperature growth surface. So this is how it's done mechanically. You put what we did is we buy 110 wafers, and we use that as a monitor to monitor the temperature. And we have a low wall, as shown in that last talk. And these are some films these are some wafer pieces that were grown with some structure on the first MVE growth. They were thinned from the back. They were cut into these small pieces, and they were set against this low wall. So the wall is sitting like this. And then when it's time to cleave, you knock a pole against it and break it off, usually with a little scratch to set the breakage about half a millimeter above this low wall back here. Right there is the low wall. A little scratch right there. It's short. And that means that the temperature at that surface that you're going to newly expose will be approximately the same as this monitor wafer. That's very important. within about 5 or 10 degrees are the same. So all of these pieces break together, and you'll see that actually better in this view graph, which is now going to go a little faster. This is loaded in the MB machine, and here's the bar which does the actual breaking. Okay? And as I say, this is just a monitor wafer. We don't do anything with this except it's a big piece that we can look and see if that second growth was adequate. And here's the here's where we are in the MBE business. I had to change the view graph because lately we've improved the arsenic. We've put an arsenic valved cracker in our system, which is a technical thing. But anyway, we've improved the mobility on the cleaved edge now to 6 million. This is relevant, actually, to this conference because it means now I think we have the capability for doing serious structures where the cleaved surface has to be high quality. And that maybe will open up an idea or two, I hope. So here's the work that Amir Yacoby did. And I want to just mention this for to sort of bring everybody, something many of you, most of you know it, but I'm going to say. So this is exactly what we talked about. We grow the single quantum well, we do the cleave, and then we grow the second, on the cleave surface, we grow the second structure, which is just this doped well. Now what's interesting about there, what's difficult about this, and what Amir Yacoby had to solve was this two serious problems, and they're both contacts. One is contact to the wire, because the wire will be right at the surface. And the other is inadvertent contact to some unintentional conducting thing underneath. Because you see this dopant is going to go all the way down here, including at the substrate. So you don't want to make a contact to this, and you do want to make contact to that reliably. And Amir Yacoby, I think, had this brilliant idea to do this step, which is complicated, and if you follow... It's not so bad if we divide it into pieces. First, I grow the first molecular beam epitaxy growth. Think of it as just an undoped quantum well. But now, actually, this time it's going to be a doped quantum well for Amir's work. So I grow a doped quantum well in this little white space there. Then Amir deposits a tungsten gate over the whole thing, going over on this piece, too. It's all one piece, long tungsten gate. Then I load the material into the machine, and I cleave it by putting my little scratch here and breaking it, and immediately grow the second MBE growth there. And all I'm going to grow now is algas with some dopants, remodulation doping. So that then puts this wire with dopant in it on that top edge. And then Amir takes this material, and he biases this tungsten wire in such a way that you put contacts here and here, and you have this 2D gas disconnected from that 2D gas by putting a negative potential on this top gate. Now the only way that you can get conductivity from this 2D gas to that 2D gas is over this corner and through this little red area, which is the quantum wire, and back over the top. That method is the only way we know how to contact cleaved edge overgrowth wires. It may be a reason to criticize the experiment, and I wanted to make a point later on about that. So I think that's all we need to say, is you can now study this. So what Amir found was this, and many, or even most of you may be familiar with this, so I'm just going to go through it briefly. The wire aspect ratio is 250 angstroms wide, and nominal, it's a triangular well, so there's a width that's 250 angstroms explicitly wide, and then there's a triangular well from the dopants to make the other part. I call that nominally 200 angstroms wide. And lastly, it's up to 10 microns long. And this is a picture of the top gate voltage versus the conductivity. And this step is the step in the conductivity, the quantized conductivity. And it's shown here in the inset in three pieces. So there's one for a 1 micron long first edge. Here's for a 2 micron long. Here's for a 5 micron long. And finally a 10. So you see for all of at least the first 1, 2, and 5, the step height is approximately equal. So that says that the wire conductivity is independent of its length in this regime. The wire aspect ratio is 400 to 1, and the quantized steps are 0.85 of the quantized conductivity, which you'd expect. And that's the point I did want to make, is at the APS meeting, there was a paper by Bruce Kane on one of our samples in which he tried to make, which he did make, quantum wires by doing standard lithography with a reservoir thinning down to a wire with a gate and then back out to a reservoir. And those wires also show roughly 0.8, 0.85 times the quantized conductance. So I do not believe, based on Bruce Kane's confirmation of this, that this is some artifact of the way the contacts are being made. I don't think I'm going to have time to... I think that's really all I want to say about wires. I made my point. So now I want to talk about lasers, and, well, at least optics experiments. So you can do the same exact experiment. You grow a quantum well, you grow some barriers on both sides of it, you do a cleave, and now instead you can grow a second quantum well so that the two wells intersect. And now let's talk about these. First of all, why would you expect such a geometry to produce a quantum wire? Well, this is a calculation by Mark Dignam, who was at Bell Labs a few years ago. And he did the calculation of the electron probability, finding the probability for finding an electron at this intersection. And this essentially shows you that there's a large probability for finding at this bound state. Why would there be such a bound state? The idea is that the wave function would expand into the three lobes of this, and by expanding, essentially, you're lowering the eigenvalue at that spot. And it's not a very large effect. You lower the eigenvalue, according to Mark, for an electron of the one I just showed you, a 70 angstrom by 70 angstrom intersection T, you lower that by about 8 millivolts. So it's a weak binding, and the escape, of course, is to one of the arm wells or the stem wells. By the way, we'll be using the terms arms and stems, and if you think of the letter T, the vertical member is the stem well, and the horizontal member is the arm well. So it can escape out one of those three modes. Well, we experimentally look for that, and indeed we find it, but we found it, in fact, larger. This is a quantum well, and this is the photoluminescence of the quantum wire, and it's shifted to the red because the eigenvalue is lowered by 17 millivolts. So it's about twice what the expectation was based on electrons. So we recently asked Song-hee to do a calculation in terms of excitons, and he's done a Monte Carlo calculation for the exciton bound state. And he finds for a 70 by 70 angstrom T wire that 17 is an entirely reasonable number. And that's his picture of the probability density projected onto that T. You notice the electron actually is a little larger. The exciton is smaller because of the hole is pulling it a little tighter. The attraction of the hole is pulling it a little tighter into the T. So now we want to talk about looking for some optics in these quantum wires. So here's the experiment that we did with...
What's the binding energy of the exciton itself?
The binding energy of the exciton, I don't remember. I do not remember what part it is. This is the laser, and it's a microprobe. And what we're going to do is make a probe that's 8,000 angstroms in diameter, and we're going to look at photoluminescence from this 8,000 angstrom spot. So we're going to pump light in this 8,000 angstrom spot, and we're only going to look at light that comes back out exactly in that same 8,000 angstrom circle with the same optics. And we could scan this way, but what we're going to do is go right over the quantum wire, single quantum wire, and we're going to then scan along the wire. So we're scanning along this length of this wire. If you do that, you see This is a single quantum wire. You see, of course, the stem well on edge. You're seeing that sort of terminated stem well because you're looking down on this thing like that. So that's just a uniform sheet. You're scanning for, by the way, a distance of 100 microns along a quantum wire. So there's the stem well. And, of course, you see the arm well because you're looking through the arm well, so to speak, to get to the stem well. So you're seeing both of those. And that's, again, more or less a uniform strip with different energies, different photoluminescence position. This is the photoluminescence energy. And finally, redshifted the most, you look at the quantum wire, which is much more jagged and discrete states. As I say, that the brightness here is red is high intensity, and green is quite low, and yellow is a little brighter than green. Now I want to show you, we're going to show you this quantum wire as a function of temperature. So what you see here now is a function of temperature is, this time we've reduced the scale even further, it's a 30 micron long piece of a quantum wire, but there's many, we've done millimeters of this wire, and it's the same for the whole length of it. But we kept scanning the same exact location. So you notice that this piece is exactly the same place on the wire. All we're doing is changing the temperature. So we can find the same places on the wire and keep scanning it over and over. We believe this is not a very profound effect. We believe it's monolayer fluctuations of the two wells. So if you have a monolayer, if you have a well that quantum well that has monolayer fluctuations in it, and you have a second one that has monolayer fluctuations, then the two in convolution will show shallow quantum dot states along the quantum wire, where at least one of the wells is locally wide. And Joel calculated this is of the order of a millivolt or two, which you'd expect for these monolayer fluctuations. The thing that was nice about this is that the geometry is lending itself to getting only a few dot states in our 8,000 angstrom probe. The reason is when you look at an 8,000 angstrom spot of an ordinary quantum well in plan view, you'll probably see lots of places where there's monolayer wide spots. But if you then further restrict the geometry such that a quantum wire is, you're looking only at a quantum wire, that limits the distance again by another factor of 100. It limits the area by a factor of 100. So you get to the situation where only one, or sometimes two, of these dot states is in any given 8,000 angstrom long segment of the wire. So the dots end up being spatially resolved. That's what seems to save the day and make this an interesting experiment. So now I want to show you that temperature dependence again. This is the temperature dependence, and what's interesting about this is that there are dot states at 4 degrees, and at 10 they sort of sit blurrier. By 15 they're getting somewhat washed out. 20, and certainly by 50 degrees you more or less have a continuous wire state. The dots are sort of, so you have the ability to tune the wire to making it sort of a quantum wire, a literal quantum wire, to one where it's a system of beaded sort of dot-like states. And so that's kind of nice if you want to study the transition between wire and dot-like regimes. So it'll be, I think, a useful tool in the future. The second thing is, because we're studying and we've made this transition between the two. The second thing is, I want you to notice this particular peak right here, and we're gonna focus on this state, and just look at this little region right here.
Lawrence,
yes. No.
So there are places where you raise the temperature and get more intense.
Yes.
Is that bothered by that?
The total photoluminescence goes down. Joel took the data, and I do not believe he's done any changing. So the answer, I believe I answered correctly to that. But I didn't actually set that color scale myself. Now let me look at this this one little peak here. This is a very peculiar thing which sort of bothered us for a while. If you look at 1565 millivolts and a half, you see a certain state. I think it's possibly this red is what's, this red is very, very bright. I think that's the problem. It's a nonlinear scale. I think that's the real problem. The difference between yellow and green isn't that much, but the difference between red and yellow is incredible. That's probably the answer. Let's look again at that. You see what I think that's? I think that's what it is. That the red is very, very bright indeed. Well, maybe not. Hard to say. But if you look at the, it's the same color scale now. If you look at this spot, at 4 degrees, this appears to be the lowest state in this particular system. By the way, we've done a statistical argument. If you look at that spectrum of dots over the 30 microns, there's about 70 lines of some sort on there. And we've done a statistical argument that made us conclude that just from the statistics of it, there's a very good likelihood that these are from the same place, the same physical spot on the wire, just from statistics. So what we think we're saying is that this is a state that apparently is not the lowest state in the system, but yet it's the lowest temperature. So as you raise the temperature, you start accessing lower energy states, which is sort of counterintuitive. But the intuition is that when you raise the temperature, you've got multiphonon processes. This is something, I believe this is an effect that was predicted in a quantum dot system by, what's his name? Weisbuch, yeah. Claude Weisbuch in France kind of predicted this sort of thing would happen and was worried for a long time that was going to limit quantum dot states to quantum dot devices to being useful, because you wouldn't be able to have the states fall, have the state, the dots fall into their lowest energy state. We see this effect apparently directly in this particular example. So we believe what's happening is that this is now falling into this state, or even to that one, because of multiphonon initial states that are allowed.
So you're saying that it's just losing, that the energy is being shifted because it's absorbing phonons when it's during the radiation process? Or are you saying?
Well, I don't know if it's the initial state or the final state. I think it's the initial state. In other words, there's more phonon pathways, essentially, as the temperature is rising. Is risen.
But the electron is sitting in the same state in all cases, but just as it emits the photon, it simultaneously emits.
No, I believe that, in fact, I believe the fact that what's happening is that you're here, you're in some excited state of this dot. It wants to be here, for example, but it decays by recombination with a hole before, in fact, it ever falls into the lower state. So when you raise the temperature, you have enough time. The time constant is short enough. It's like a branching ratio, if you think about it that way, right? You're at this state, and it would want it to fall to this one or that one. In fact, it branches to the K mode of the thing, where the exon combines with the hole. So we have a direct evidence of an interesting effect, and we think it's a multiphonon effect. Now I want to talk about lasers. Why would we talk about lasers? The reason is that lasers for quantum wires are sort of a natural thing to think about. This is the density of states in 3D, and the first lasers made in the 1970s were all 3D lasers. As people learned to make quantum wells and to make reliable quantum wells, they started making quantum well lasers, and now all of the CD players you have on your house are quantum well lasers. And now the latest thing is to think about whether lower dimensionality will improve the density of states, because the lasing will occur at the band edge. I have to really move. Here's our laser. This was made by Wegscheider and I several years ago, and it essentially is 20 such quantum wires, 70 angstrom by 70 angstrom quantum wires, in a cavity. And the thing that's interesting, so these are the 20 T wires right here. Here's just the picture of a wave function on one of them. The thing that you need to do is have confining barriers above and below, so you maximize to make a laser, you have to make two things. You have to make an excitonic wire, and you have to make an optical wire. And the optical wire means that the optical density has to be very high over the excitonic part. So we want to have a big optical mode right here. And we do this by making this particular material 10% Algas, which pulls the mode. It's gallium arsenide-like, and it pulls the mode over here so it doesn't go racing down to this far end. And here's a calculation of that optical mode in our structure. And indeed, it covers the middle 7 or 8 wires, but in fact, it could be improved. It would be nice to make the optical mode a little bit more coincident with the excitonic modes. And here's a picture to show you what cleaved edge overgrowth sample looks like in a sort of a large scale. Here's the laser. This is a physical, real picture of the sample in TEM. These are the 20 layers. This is the confining material on both sides. That's the cleaved material. And that's the whole structure, including junk material that's way out of the picture. So the individual wires then are right there. I just blowed up. You can see these are the individual T's. So the laser then would look like this. We're talking now about optically pumped lasers, and you put a green pump, and you'd look for light, a high energy pump, and you'd look for light along the ends of the quantum wire, coming out the ends on surfaces. And the laser was published a while ago, and it has this property. This is the photoluminescence you saw already, 17 millivolt shift from the quantum wire. This is the quantum wells from the well and from the stem and the arm wells. As you start moving the optical power up, this jumps up by factors of 1,000, starts lasing, multimode, and the quantum well just stays there. If you pump harder still at 50 milliwatts, this goes up by a factor of 10 million compared to this in a single mode. And what's interesting is that the quantum well has shifted in energy downwards. And that's the result that we're pumping so hard that we're getting a sea of phonons and electrons. And that's band gap renormalization. And that's an indication that the density of excitons is very, very high in the system, you know, the Mott limit. It's of the order of the Mott limit with an effector of 3. That's all I can say. I get this from an injection laser, which we aren't going to talk about today. And this is a view graph to show you all we're doing is doing near field on the edge of this. So these are the laser pieces. And this is optical near field. We're going to pump it with energetic light and then scan across this surface on the cleaved edge, looking to see where the light's coming from. How does it relate? And this is data that was published by Grober and us. So we're looking at the near field, say, of the blue, for example, here. And that's the photoluminescence. If you look at the blue, you see only the quantum stem wells are blue. If you look at the green, only the arm well is showing up in a little leakage into the thing. And if you look at the red, where we think the wire is, only the intersection of the wires. So this is sort of a proof that what we're saying about these wires is correct. Now I want to talk to you about the temperature properties of the quantum wire laser. The temperature properties are, again, you're just pumping it, and you're measuring this function of temperature, and the threshold is defined as the place where the slope changes, where the light output goes non-linearly with the pumping power. And you see that this particular laser works out to about 50 degrees Kelvin. It's interesting because I was telling you about these dot-like wires and these wire-like wires, and there's no difference, so there's nothing happening here. I believe that, and also it should be remembered, when I was telling you about the single quantum wires, those are very low excitation pumping powers. Here we're pumping huge, near the Mott limit, we're pumping enormous rate numbers of excitons per linear centimeter of the thing. So that I believe this is an irrelevant comment. The thing is wire-like because it's essentially band filling of all those dot states. So we'd like to go higher in temperature. And how to do that? Well, we started And this is how I'm going to close this talk. We started to think about a new structure, and this is the one which our poster paper will be on. The poster paper is written by Jaime Rubio, who's a postdoc now at Bell Labs. And he started investigating, at my suggestion, this different kind of a structure. Instead of having two stem well and an arm well that looked the same, we thought of filling this with a low percentage of aluminum gallium arsenide, sort of lifting the DC level of that up a little bit. This is the kind of structure. And then the arm well is just conventional, the way it always was. When you make the first arm well structure that we studied to get to laser, this is the first laser we got to do that, we put 3% L-gas in the stem, but it's a 70 angstrom stem. And this is the laser, we got a fairly low laser threshold of 40 millivolts. And this is the temperature dependence of it. Finally, at about 90 Kelvin, the laser stops functioning. But this is a reasonably low, as low as a threshold laser as we'd ever made up to this point. And what we then did was try to do a control experiment where we said, instead of 3% L gas in a 70 angstrom stem, where I've got a mixture of some confinement and some DC sort of L gas offset, I'm going to double the stem to 140 angstroms. That'll reduce the confinement energy, so I better up the DC level, and I calculated we need about 7% material to do that. So it's going to have the same energy difference that it had before, but it's now going to be all DC offset instead of confinement energy. And we got a big surprise. So we got a lower threshold by a factor of 4. That wasn't a surprise if you think about it, because if you essentially make it from 70 angstrom to 140, you've doubled the material. So the exciton-photon overlap is improved by a factor of 2, and you get that twice, once in the gamma for emission and once in the absorption. So that's not so surprising, although it's awfully certainly welcome. What's nice is that we had this strange new effect occur. So what happens? At 12 degrees, we get the single-line quantum wire state. As we raise the temperature, everything seems normal, except here it's single mode, here it's less single mode, and all of a sudden it's shared with this strange friend, 14 millivolts to the blue. And then at 60 degrees Kelvin, this has gone away, and this is more or less gone, and it goes up to there, finally to where it quits. And we were stunned by this. I really was. And so... we studied the temperature dependence, and it looks like that. Very sharp. So the onset, well, the place where it goes from 10% to 90% switch from the high energy mode to the low energy mode is 3 degrees Kelvin. So this sharp change suggests some sort of possibly a phase transition, and we're looking into what's happening. Just to give you some more background on that, this is what happens with pump power. Same thing happens with pump power. This is all taken, I think it's 57 degrees. And all we're going to do is increase the power. Here's you're just barely at threshold, just above threshold. And then you get single mode. Finally, you get the two modes, and they coexist with the high energy mode winning over, finally. That's right at the transition temperature you looked at before. So I want to show you how these modes look like. This is the last view graph. How they look like in terms of the quantum well. See, the quantum well is blue of all of this stuff. This is, we think, unrelated to the quantum well. This difference of 15, or it's actually 14 millivolts in most of the samples, we asked Song-hee to look at it, and he calculated that the energy to, which is really an answer to your question in a way, is the energy to make the a bound exciton turned into a free electron hole pair, but still be bound in the wire. So that's sort of Bert's question, I guess. Is he got 13.7 millivolts for this particular geometry. So it's possible that this is a transition from an electron hole, from an exciton to an electron hole plasma, but that's certainly not written in stone, and we don't really know what's going on. And I think that's just open. Here shows you a very crude partial phase diagram where we're making interpretations, but anyway, something, this is the low energy state and the high energy state, if you like, what's happening between these two. And it's sort of curving over, as you might expect, into two regions.
Why would it be one of the highest up factors?
Well, we thought about that. The first excited state that, that Song he thought was important, in, and I don't know quite what that word means, was he got something about 7 millivolts. So we haven't looked seriously at simple-minded things like heavy hole, light hole effects, but I don't think they're relevant. But that's where it is, and that's with that I'd like to close. Thank you. Sure.
So how long is the lasing? I mean, could there be resonances due to mirrors or something?
Well, the way these lasers work, I didn't get a chance to say that. They're typically all of the lasers that were built lately are half a millimeter long. You can make lasers as long as a millimeter and as short as maybe a couple hundred microns.
Okay, so the spacing between modes is very
small. Very small. By the way, this work then is covered in a poster that I hope that you'll all look at with Jaime in the back. Jaime's here. He's a postdoc from Spain, Jaime Rubio. He'll be at the poster with me. Yes?
How long before you cleave a second time?
We've cleaved the second time. My postdoc, Werner Weitscheider, actually sort of took that project and really ran with it. I could have shown you that. It's really very nice. Werner Weitscheider took a quantum wire and cleaved it and made a quantum dot and proved that he had a quantum dot by having two such quantum wires and cleaving it and making two such dots and then varying the spacing between the dots and getting very nice resonance effects. So I believe he's got a solid piece of work there, and that's I think that was written up in Science, as I remember it lately.
So, I think we'll stick with it.